From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Calling Florida's prisons a ticking time bomb, members of the union representing the state's corrections officers have called for an emergency state legislative session to address issues ranging from poor facility conditions to high staff turnover and understaffing that they say creates dangerous conditions for corrections officers and inmates. We'll take a closer look at current conditions. Plus, the number of babies born dependent on addictive opioid drugs like methadone, heroin, or OxyContin is on the rise here in Florida and around the nation. We'll explore the impact of neonatal abstinence syndrome, the underlying causes and conditions, and how the state and local medical providers are responding. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for being with us. The number of babies born physically dependent to drugs is on the rise in Florida and around the nation. The condition, called neonatal abstinence syndrome, occurs in newborns who were exposed to addictive opiate drugs in their mother's womb. According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, the number of babies born with NAS increased fivefold from 2000 to 2012. According to the Florida Agency for Health Care Administration, nearly 2,500 Florida newborns had NAS in 2015, compared to 1,900 the previous year and just over 1,300 5 years before that. Here in Southwest Florida, Lee Memorial Health System reports that the number of babies born in their hospitals with neonatal abstinence syndrome has increased dramatically in recent years, from just 8 cases in 2005 to 122 cases last year. Newborns suffer painful withdrawal symptoms and require costly extended hospital stays. We're exploring underlying causes for the increase in NAS, how Florida is addressing the problem, including the creation of a statewide task force, and how Southwest Florida health officials are responding. Joining me now is Dr. William Liu. He's with Pediatrics Medical Group and the medical director of the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit at the Golisano Children's Hospital of Southwest Florida. Welcome, Dr. Liu. Good to speak with you again.
Thank you for inviting me.
We're also joined by neonatologist Dr. Prabhu Parimi. He's chief of the Division of Neonatology at All Children's Hospital and director of the John Hopkins All Children's Maternal, Fetal, and Neonatal Institute. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you, John. Thanks for inviting me.
And Dr. Washington Hill is with us as well. He's with the Florida Department of Health in Sarasota County. Welcome to the program, Dr. Hill.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And I invite listeners to join us as well. Phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. Tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live or send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And first of all, Dr. Parimi, can you tell us a bit more about what neonatal abstinence syndrome actually is and what kind of symptoms newborns with this exhibit?
So neonatal abstinence syndrome is characterized by a constellation of symptoms. So we currently use a 1970 developed scoring system called Finnegan scoring system, and they fall into three major domains. The first one is the one we talked to you about is the gastrointestinal, that is related to poor feeding, regurgitation, projectile vomiting, loose or watery stools. And that's because of specific withdrawal symptoms related to the GI or the stomach or GI system. The second symptomatology we really look at is because of autonomic overactivity. That's where babies have sweating, fever, frequent yawning, stuffiness, sneezing, and also they may have increased respiratory effort. And the last domain that these babies fall under is related to the brain or the central nervous system, where they have high-pitched cry. They do not sleep as much as they're supposed to, particularly for the newborn babies, and the tone is significantly increased. And some infants may also present with the seizure activity or the convulsions. So all of those things are manifestations of neonatal abstinence syndrome, otherwise referred to as narcotic withdrawal in newborn babies.
Now, does the type of narcotic that perhaps they were exposed to in utero in any way impact the treatment?
So the as you are well aware, I think the largest proportion of babies, at least we're seeing, are the ones, the moms who've been exposed to the use of opiates, and that's the oxycodone and so on and so forth. Yes, the time of this symptomatology typically varies depending upon the dose the mother had been on and the type of medication. For example, some medications, they manifest early as 3 days, but large proportion of babies present around 5th to 7th day of age. So dosing as well as the type of medication used by the mothers, the pregnant mothers, have an impact on the symptoms and the timing of symptoms as well.
Okay. And Dr. Liu, when did you first start noticing that cases of neonatal abstinence syndrome were increasing?
Well, here in Southwest Florida, we have been following our babies from a database since 2002, and we have had a fairly consistent evaluative protocol that involves screening these mothers who are at higher risk and observing them for a one-week period in-house if we feel they have significant, specifically opioid exposure, which, as already noted, is by Dr. Perini, is the area of medication that we're most concerned about. So into 2005 to 2008, that's probably when we began to see the significant rise in our incidence of neonatal abstinence syndrome. And into 2009, that's when we started to try to mobilize the community to increase awareness. And that pretty much was concurrent with a statewide as well as national recognition that this was becoming a problem. I guess you can sort of say in terms of the general trend that probably from 2005 up until 2010, that was the most rapid rise. And we saw about a 700 to 800% increase in our number of admissions for neonatal abstinence syndrome at that time.
And is there any danger, I suppose, in not slowly weaning these babies off of their dependence? What would happen, say, if they just kind of had to suffer their withdrawal symptoms?
Okay, well that's a very good question. I think that the question of what is the best way to manage opioid withdrawal in the neonatal period, quite honestly, there is not a lot of good randomized clinical trials that have studied that question. But in general terms, the prospect of allowing a child to just overtly go through, I guess, a cold turkey type of withdrawal probably would result in extreme exacerbation of some of the symptoms that Dr. Perini mentioned. Certain concerns would be that they actually develop acute respiratory symptoms or develop seizures. The other underlying aspect of management really relates to more of a softer sense of what is best for optimal brain development. Mm. And as you can imagine, babies at the time of the newborn period are in a particularly vulnerable time frame in terms of being exposed to insults to brain development. And to allow that vulnerable brain to go through active withdrawal would be very concerning. So in general terms, the medical consensus is that we should try to treat the babies with pharmacological therapy and wean them in a gradual way, similar to the way adults are, I guess you can say, detoxified from addiction.
Gotcha. And I was wondering if you'd noticed any trends in neonatal abstinence syndrome cases related to Florida's crackdown on pill mills. And by that I mean, you know, outside the hospital as the state was cracking down on these unscrupulous clinics, and then, you know, these prescription drugs became less available, you know, more people were turning to heroin. Did you notice, you know, more cases of neonatal abstinence syndrome in babies of mothers who had been using heroin?
Well, again, I can speak very specifically to our region, which may not necessarily reflect statewide or national trends. But within our region, concurrent with a statewide and probably national initiative to do exactly what you're saying, which is increased drug enforcement legislation, specifically targeting pill mills. We did see probably from 2011 to 2012 a flattening of our curve in terms of the number of, and rate of neonatal abstinence syndrome. I guess concurrent with that as well, if you look at a statewide level, if you look use the ARCOS database, which looks at the top oxycodone prescribers in the country, mm-hmm. in 2010, the state of Florida had 98 of the top 100 oxycodone prescribers. By 2012, this had dropped to zero. So that reflects a profound impact of state, regional initiatives to target the availability of prescription drugs. Again, during that period of time, we did see a flattening of our rate of neonatal abstinence syndrome, which was probably running close to 11 to 12 per thousand live births, and it stayed about at that level. However, into 2012 through 2015, we've seen another resurgence in our total number as well as rate of neonatal abstinence syndrome. And just to give you an idea, probably from 2013 to 2015, we've seen an additional maybe 30% or so increase in our number of admissions. So in effect, the local initiatives to increase public awareness, the regional and state as well as national initiatives to improve physician awareness, drug prescription monitoring program, state legislative action, as well as legal law enforcement, putting teeth into law enforcement. Those initiatives may have had a slight improvement in our area, and when I look at the ACA numbers statewide, they did not have much of an impact. And into the last two or three years, I think what we are seeing, and I would say this anecdotally, and maybe some of the other speakers might be able to give their local experience, is that we are seeing less the traditional prescription drug abuse and more illicit drug usage, specifically heroin. We're even seeing things like fentanyl and Dilaudid. But again, I don't have the actual data on that. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that our mothers who are in the maternal methadone program, which comprise about maybe 45% of our total admissions for NAS, have remained relatively constant. So this would suggest that the delta or the incremental increase is related more to the made possibly decreased availability of the traditional prescription drug source and the abusing public, if you will, seeking out other alternative sources.
Dr. Liu, I'm a little confused about that there, particularly with methadone, because presumably that would be prescribed by a physician who would know that these women are pregnant. Explain that for me. Why would they do that?
Okay.
This is Dr. Hill.
Yes, Dr. Hill.
Help you there. You're right that methadone has to be prescribed by a physician, and actually you have to have a particular license to do that. But there are clinics in our area here in Sarasota and down there as well, and I know also in Port Charlotte, where patients will be getting their methadone non-pregnant and then become pregnant, and they will continue on their methadone. And in fact, sometimes they will have that dose increase. So methadone can be prescribed legally by some physicians. Now, the other problem is that patients, I had a patient just the other day who was on methadone, and I always ask them, where did you get it? Mm-hmm. And the correct answer is a clinic called PAR, P-A-R. That's a federally clinic, that able to prescribe methadone. But some of these patients obtain their medication from other sources, friends, off the street, family members, and they will be using methadone actually illegally and continue to use it during their pregnancy, and that's what produces the NAS babies. Not only methadone, but they may be using another drug called Suboxone and can obtain it in the same way.
Do these women simply not know that it could be having an impact on their baby, or, you know, they're just afraid of what would happen if they did stop taking it, so they just do, even though they know it could have an impact?
Well, that's a complex question.
Yeah, several questions in there. Sorry.
As your other guests would mention as well, the patients, the one I can visualize in my mind is the last one I saw who was taking Suboxone from a friend. Mm. Now you say, does she know that this could harm her fetus or cause the fetus to have NAS? Yes. I don't think any of these patients don't know that, but they have an addiction, and addiction is a powerful thing. So in spite of the fact that they're pregnant, they will continue to use methadone or Suboxone or alcohol or heroin or get something off the street because they have an addiction. Now, many of them will use methadone and try to stay on a low dose and try to get off of it after they have delivered. Others do just the opposite.
Gotcha. And Dr. Liu, how, you know, at least within Lee Memorial Health Systems, how do you address the mothers in terms of follow-up? Do hospitals get other social service agencies involved? What's the process?
So the infant who has a diagnosis of Neoadjuvant syndrome, all those babies are followed in our developmental clinic. We also involve social services, of course, for all these babies. I think I want to kind of go back to what Dr. Hill was talking about.
Yes.
I think that certainly we can follow these babies, and we recognize that these babies are at higher risk. But as I've talked before about, I think that you know what we are seeing with Neoadjuvant syndrome is really the tip of the iceberg. I mean, it really reflects a much more global and societal challenge. As Washington mentioned, you know, many of these women know that this is not a good thing. They know that that they're doing something that is not in their or their baby's best interest. But addiction, the issue of addiction and the risk factors for addiction may be the more the root cause that we need to look at and speak about. When I go back to what you're talking about, we do try to make these women more aware. Within our own unit, there are some of the NICU nurses have really championed trying to proactively communicate with the women who actually we've even talked about going to the PAR clinic, although we haven't gotten to that point. Mm. But we did have three regional coalitions that have specifically looked to targeting women of childbearing age before they're pregnant and increasing awareness. But as you can see in the numbers, it had absolutely no impact. In fact, the problem continues to grow. So I think that might be something that when we look at what we're doing, certainly we want to follow them, as you asked me, and we definitely do follow them, and we recognize they are at higher risk for long-term developmental issues. The factors, of course, there are many factors that can contribute to that. But again, it's always a kind of a pay me now, pay me later challenge. If you look at the whole issue of drug dependency in our society, and are we just the canary in the coal mine type of thing, and we're noticing these babies that are, the rates are going up significantly. But I think the whole, in terms of looking at all society, we need to look at what are the factors that increase the risk for drug dependency in society.
Mm. And John, if I may, I just want to add something there. I think which I think is very well known is that the care along the whole continuum is very fragmented. So I think what we are contemplating. In fact, we began that effort here is to provide this continuum of care model for this. That means that there got to be a significant emphasis on the management, particularly I call it the primary prevention of the mother. Because I think there's a lot of resources that are they utilize it. In fact, I'm not sure if they have access to those things there, particularly the social worker, and then do they have access to the pain clinic, a combination of neonatologists and pediatrician, a psychiatry, and so on and so forth. I think what I think to me is very crucial is to have that concerted effort of all the key stakeholders, as just was mentioned by Dr. Liu, not only the physician group. I think the federal government, the state government, and the community leaders. I think we need to work along the whole continuum to improve not only care to the babies, but in fact to the mother-infant diets, both short-term as well as long-term, and as was pointed out, would have significant impact not just on societal, but a financial impact as well, as everybody is aware at this point in time.
Right, right.
It's very important to do that. And one place to start, of course, is with the woman when she's not pregnant. And to try to help her with her addiction. And then not only to do that, through social services, Healthy Start, et cetera, but then one of the things that we tried at Sarasota Memorial was making sure that the CAR clinics, these clinics, methadone clinics, are also discussing these issues with the patient and prescribing contraception while they're on methadone. So we don't have an NAS unless the mother is pregnant, correct? So using contraception would be, along with the methadone, would be helpful. We've had some success there and some not success. The other issue is the clinics that prescribe methadone are really, they really have an opportunity to help us. But what I mean by that is by encouraging their patients to lower their dose and to get off methadone. Mm-hmm. Some patients can get off methadone and function, and some cannot. But we've always had a problem, and some of our NICU nurses have had a problem with these clinics continuing to prescribe and sometimes even increase the dose during pregnancy.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are coming up to the end of the hour, so we're going to have to end the conversation there. But thank you so much to my guests. We've been speaking with Dr. William Liu. He's medical director of the neonatal intensive care unit at the Golisano Children's Hospital of Southwest Florida. He's also with Pediatrics Medical Group. Dr. Prabhu Parimi is chief of the Division of Neonatology at All Children's Hospital and director of the Johns Hopkins All Children's Maternal, Fetal, and Neonatal Institute. And we've also been speaking with Dr. Washington Hill. He's with us from the Florida Department of Health in Sarasota County. Thanks so much to you all for being with us.
My pleasure.
There's more information on today's show and past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers Richard Chinqui, AJ Leonard, and Tara Callaghan. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.